Thanks again, Chairman. It's Red. I'll just open the meeting. Take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Welcome to any visitors and a huge welcome to any newcomers that might be with us tonight. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we do have a speaker this evening. And I can't believe I've never asked this, we've never had this person share before for us, actually. I apologise for that, because they've been coming to our meetings for a while, over a period of years, I think, possibly over time. I've never heard their story, so I'm really looking forward to hearing it. And unusually, I can't think I've ever introduced a speaker to this meeting that was literally geographically a neighbour, and this individual is, although I don't think we've ever met face to face, so maybe one day that will change. So I'm going to introduce you to Jackie, who's come along to share her experience, strengths and hope with us for 40 or 45 minutes, whatever she's comfortable with. Tell us her story, experience, strength and hope of her recovery. So Jackie, over to you. Please share with us.
Thank you, Steve. My name's Jackie and I'm an addict.
Hello, hello Jackie. Jackie. Hello.
Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
It's always good to hear someone's story that you know them from meetings, but you've not heard their story, because I've belonged to home groups, and it's not until somebody shares, doesn't mean share, you get to know them properly. And So a lot of my story is obviously has been learned in retrospect. I wouldn't have understood as things were happening, what was happening. But it's by looking back over the years, for instance, I can see that as a child, I had addictive behavior. I liked to go to the sweet shop, and over time, if I didn't have money for my sweets, I'd have a go stealing them. And I got caught once or twice, and I was only young. I was old enough to go out to the sweet shop on my own, but to have developed that, I would see that as something amiss, you know. And I can think of other behaviours. As I grew up, I think I was first given wine to drink at a meal. It was probably Christmas, something like that. And I was given a glass of wine, I think it was white wine, and I drank that down and was given another one and drank that down, enjoying myself. And then was then told that was it, you're not having any more, because you were obviously enjoying that far too much. And so looking back, there was I had a very difficult childhood. My mother was 16 when she had me, and this is back in the 50s, so she escaped the mental hospital that they put unmarried mothers into at a young age for being morally deficient, I think it was. But all the same, she was in the grip of the sort of social services and those that afflicted their moral values on everybody. She was not, though she tried, she was not allowed to keep me. I was looked after by family members and neighbours and fostered, but eventually I was put into Barnardo's for adoption. And I was around the age of 4, I think. And I remembered my family very well. And I was used to my mum dropping me off. She worked and she picked me up later. And it was a horrible realization when somebody, you know, because I insisted I'd be quite often hanging around waiting for my mother to come back and fetch me. And somebody yelled at me one day that she was not coming back. She was not coming to get me. And, you know, sort of said it in, you know, no uncertain terms that it sunk in. And I think that was a great blow for me, you know. So then I did get adopted, and it was into a quite a strict middle class family, not the same sort of family that I'd come from. And another thing before that happened was that I played a lot with my cousin Jane around my Auntie Barbara's and Uncle Sid's, and they wanted to adopt me but weren't allowed. But that was a, you know, quite a painful thing, not just for me but for the whole family, that I only found out about years down the line. And we were all broken hearted, you know. Anyway, so I got adopted into this strict family. My mother was an actress who'd actually given up a really good career to have children. Again, sort of trying to do the done thing, you know, the two children, one of each. She couldn't have her own. And her husband was an engineer, but he'd been a lieutenant commander in the Navy. And they were strict people. And we clashed. Again, looking back, you know, had our own upsets and miseries. I realize now that I grieved for my family, and my mother couldn't really cope with me. She wanted to give me back to Barnardo's, but was persuaded by the social workers to continue. So this unhappy situation continued. We lived in London. They then moved to the seaside, which was great. It's down on the Dorset coast. Beautiful. And they got a small hotel down there. my behaviour at school wasn't great. I was intelligent, but I talked about and would find myself in trouble or being sent to the headmistress and that sort of thing. I left home when I was just 15. I had a boyfriend and left home with him. I didn't stay and do my exams or anything like that. I was already using. I took acid and smoked dope to begin with. Hippies had come over from the Isle of Wight Festival in 70, 71, I think it was. But prior to that, I knew the dealers. And when I took LSD, my sort of innocence of school and, you know, a possible career, you know, possible things I might study. I was good at art and English. Ceased to interest me, really. And I'd go into school, tripping, and leave again, you know. So I left home, but I continued to write to one of my best friends, and unfortunately the old Bill got the address and I got caught and brought home, and then was out of care and control by the authorities, you know. And my parents, I think they definitely gave it their best shot, you know. They were trying to teach me as best they could. I never felt loved there, though. I didn't. But, you know, their way of showing love was to give me a secure home. You know, I was safe. I was, well, apart from when I got hit, I suppose. You know, they did their best. They weren't deliberately being horrible to me, although that's what it felt like sometimes. It's a shame. There were instances and times in that period that were enjoyable, like my mum would take me to the ballet or the theatre. I'd enjoyed that. But most of the time it was difficult. So I'd left, then I got brought back. Then there was a court case for underage sex from my boyfriend, and I covered for him, saying that he didn't know how old I was or that I'd pretended I was older. It's odd, you know, though, to consider you know, we have paedophilia, and I didn't sort of think about any of that, you know. And what I've discovered, and in fact what I was told, was actually told this because I went to treatment centres for my active addiction, that you don't emotionally develop when you start using. And when you get clean, which I was extremely fortunate to do, you revert to that age. So I started fairly young. And it's a convoluted story. I went off to a voluntary place, but it was better than in a sort of approved school or you know, a remand center or anything like that. It was out near Southampton, and I was to remain there till I was 16 and could get my insurance cards and work. And I got my boyfriend a job there doing gardening, much to my poor adopted mother's dismay. And the relationship continued. We smoked dope all the time. You could get a good deal for two and a half grams or something. You know, the dope used to come off the boats in Southampton at £10 an ounce back then. And that's what we did. We smoked hash. You know, I loved pottery and I did a pottery course. I helped out in a secondhand shop and got on with most of the girls. They had either come from mental hospitals or one way or another they couldn't live at home. And remember my father driving me to this place when I went there, and he said to me, and me and him did not have a great relationship at all, but I realized that he was a very emotional guy, but like everyone, but he had no ways of kind of knowing how to do that and to express himself. But he said to me, we didn't want it to be like this or end up like this, you know. And I said, I know. And that was that, really. And I never wanted anything like responsibility. I didn't want to, you know, care about anything. I still had the pain inside me about massive curiosity about my real mother, what on earth had happened to her and why had she left me and da da da. And Bernardo's tell you little snippets, they don't tell you the story. Tell you little bits and pieces. One time at this place in Southampton, the staff were all out and one bright spark broke into the office and we got to read all our files. We had very, very, very little time to try and read quite an amount of stuff. But that was there that I discovered that my parents had tried to give me back to Bernardo's and couldn't cope. And various things like that. So trying to think, you know, although I say only smoking dope, I know in NA that doesn't matter how much or what we used, but because it kind of took over our lives, I can see now that addiction was just the way it was for me and my partner. If we didn't have any, we were out getting some more sort of thing, you know, and drink a little bit and hang out with some pretty strange people. I got a job eventually, worked in a little restaurant down by the docks. I'm trying to think what happened next. I think it probably suffices to say that we travelled between London and various other places, spent some time in Scotland after London, and we were just always smoking dope. We were, I'd smoke it at work if I could get away with it, and I did in a place in London where I worked. And Yeah, then we went up to Scotland for about a year. I lived out on an island, Arran. Lived on Arran. And what I wanted to do was visit all the islands. But we stayed there and worked. There was quite a community. Some local, but mostly people from all around the world that had come to settle there and make a little living from the tourists somehow. I'd pick whelks up off the beach and sell them for cash and work in the cafes, that sort of thing, and drink a lot. And I was still quite young. Back to London for the money, because things like paying the rent were not high up on our priorities, you know. And so it was back to London. And up in Scotland, I worked for some candle makers. And learned how to do that. I was learning how to, because I was good at art, I was learning how to draw onto leather and paint onto leather. So you use a particular type of leather, you can wet it and emboss it, you know. And used to sell stuff down Camden Lock. Worked for some quite posh leather workers in Mayfair for a while. And then back out into the countryside again, this time out east. And the marriage didn't last after my first son was born. So I was on my own for a bit. Then I was with someone else and had a daughter. The next relationship, my disease ramped up into the class A's. Got more serious. That relationship lasted a bit longer, but I was again eventually on my own. And we got by okay, but the more I used heroin, the more trouble I would get into. And when the second relationship failed, was actually quite upset, and of course used to deal with my emotions. Had another relationship. The last two were really with guys that could supply me with drugs, really. And I had another son and started to get into real trouble. My eldest son went to live with his dad, because I was getting arrested for petty crime, and they was all worried about his progress at school, which wasn't great. And then my daughter's father decided maybe he'd take her as well. And by the time the third relationship failed, I was in bits, and my using spiraled downhill. And I was using anything and everything. Because I'd lost all these court custody cases for my children, and I knew I'd go crazy without my kids. They sort of kept me together a bit, my children, and I was extremely codependent on them. Didn't really have any other family. And I was really, really, really sad to the point of suicidal. But I knew if I killed myself, I'd never see them again. So I didn't kill myself, but I used a lot, and my life was a complete mess. Everything was a mess. And it got really, really bad. And got to the point where I couldn't live like it anymore. Now, I'd had a couple of goes at getting clean in the treatment center. There was the court case and, you know, the hair tests and all that. But, you know, the drug services gave me methadone. When my daughter was young, if I could have got to a rehab to take her with me, I would have done it because I knew I had a problem. But no, they give you the old methadone, you know, and that lasted a long, long time. And all I did was increase my usage, buy other people's, use loads of other drugs as well. So by the time I'd really, really had enough, and asked for help. And very, very luckily I was given it in the form of, you know, funding for treatment centres. I couldn't have done it on my own at home. I had several different prescriptions, including methadone, loads of benzos, and I was using street drugs as well, buying other people's prescriptions, all that. It was very sad. It's a very sad story as I sort of remember it now. I know there were good bits, but most of it was miserable, really. Let me think. So I went for a detox, and I didn't want to go to a 12-step treatment centre, and I asked them not to send me to one because I didn't want, you know, to see God in the 12 steps hanging on the wall. And I'd seen this before. I'd seen it when I was going through the court case with my son. How it happened. But I went to some meetings, and the man who is my great, my grand sponsor, used to give me lifts out to meetings. But I was like, well, I was still taking some codeine, and I felt like a fraud, and I thought, you all can do this, but I can't do this. And, but I met some people, including my present day sponsor. She spent a lot of time on the phone with me, bless her. So then I went to a treatment center that's actually near where I live, 6 months. Having got clean, learned how to stay clean. And by this time, I wasn't quite as arrogant and everything type thing, and I enjoyed going to the meetings. I actually did. I'd never met clean addicts before. Never heard of anyone getting clean before, really. And nobody I knew. And it was all quite incredible that I listened to these people, and I knew they knew what they were talking about, and there they were. And I'd H&I had brought them into the other place I was at. And again, you know, they had jobs and their own place to live, and they had a sense of humour, and I came back to my old house, had some sort of aftercare as well, met a few clean addicts in my area, and started going to meetings, and had a home group that I used to go to for about probably 15 years, you know. Learned how to do service. And learned the values that I'd thrown away, you know, that paid no interest in. Learned how to be appropriate with people. Took my recovery pretty seriously. Probably sometimes too seriously, I think back, but I'd had a very short relapse after leaving treatment, and that scared me. It was with some weed around one of my family members, and I never wanted to do that again. So the last time I did that, used drugs, was July 2005. And I never wanted to use again. And it was fortunate in a way, because I could, you know, associate with my family, and they could be doing whatever they were doing, and I didn't want to use. So it served a purpose, really. And over time, I met some amazing people. Brilliant sponsor through the steps. Halfway through them again, I sort of come to a bit of a block at the moment, really, because I got involved in an awful lot of service at Strange, because it's a virtual meeting, but its name relates to where I live, and it began where I live. Southwest England in Gloucestershire. And various important guidelines were thrown out of this meeting in order to keep it going. For instance, clean time requirements. And kept going. I've helped to keep going 2 meetings a day. So that's 14 meetings a week for the past year. And this month, my service is up. I've been the treasurer and the chair of the group conscience. And a couple of days ago, an emergency group conscience was called, primarily by the using addicts, who obviously didn't like the way the vote went the previous week, where we'd brought in requirements for clean time requirements for service. And they have the keys of the room, and they do not have, they're not working programs or anything. It's become impossible to remain, really. So I think a few of the core members are going to start another group. I've always liked coming to these meetings at Higna. They're so well organized, so calming and comforting. The meetings I've been involved with for the past year have been the polar opposite, quite rowdy, loads of newcomers, absolutely loads of newcomers. And not unusual to be 40, 50 people in a meeting. And I know people. I have a sponsee even that got clean on that meeting. And for those reasons, I stayed so long, but it's become quite sick. And I read, Tradition One, and yet the group, particularly the trusted servants that I'm doing service with, need to be having their program as well, or it's almost impossible to work with them, I'm very, very grateful that Narcotics Anonymous gave me another chance at life. I wouldn't be sitting here today without Narcotics Anonymous. I wouldn't have learned what love was. Not really. I mean, I am a loving person, and I loved my children. But because I was a using addict, they were neglected. They were not brought up properly. They saw things children shouldn't see. And thanks to my work in the 12 steps that I was able to shed a lot of that guilt and shame. And that ultimately ask for forgiveness and forgive myself. That's taken time, recovery is a process, not an event, as I'm reminded from time to time. I think I'm getting close to my time being up. I'm bound to have left out a lot of stuff and given a sort of bare outline, really. But I have a loving higher power in my life that helped me and continues to help me. More powerful than the disease of addiction. And I absolutely loved working step two and discovering this, free. And I still say the third step prayer, meditate when I can, gives me emotional stability, meditation. I act out more than I should, and I'm not strict about inventory and all that. I should do things that I used to do and have let slip, you know. I'm very grateful for my life. It's beautiful. I sit here in my little front room and I see the silver birch trees swaying out the back. And I'm content. I'm at peace. That is not all the time. The nonsense that went on at my old home group, I call it my old home group, I haven't quite left. I'm supposed to be doing service tonight and there's a final group conscience tomorrow. But I think that's just where we say our goodbyes, really. Sometimes you give something your best shot, don't you? And maybe that just wasn't meant to be, or maybe somebody else will make it work. God knows. I don't. And I think I better leave it there, really. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for being here with me tonight. Love you all.